Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So this week we have corporate manipulation of the internet by bribing nutritionist influencers, anger management, a strategy that I think all of us could maybe give a try to. Cholesterol-lowering probiotics are on the horizon. Exciting. Micro-RNA machines to fight cancers. And two stories about autoimmune disease, along with some very interesting emails. And let's launch into our first story. This from the corporate propaganda files. I wonder how much stock in Novo Nordisk and E.I. Lilly, General Mills owns. It must be something because big food and dietitians that they pay rather hefty fees to, because their influencers are pushing an anti-diet advice. We'll just start with this story that came from the Washington Post. A lady named Jay Rashawn has been, like many of us, struggling to lose weight for many years. And she really felt relieved when she discovered a bunch of YouTube influencers advocating health at every size, urging her to stop dieting and to listen to her mental hunger. So she stopped avoiding foods like cupcakes and Nutella, which she had a mental hunger for. They made me feel like it was safe, eating whatever I wanted, said Rashawn, 51, a video editor in Wausau, Wisconsin. In 2 months, she gained 50 pounds. As her weight neared 300 pounds, she began to worry about her health. The videos that Rashawn encounters are part of the anti-diet movement, a social media juggernaut that began as a way to, it began originally as an effort to combat weight stigma and an unhealthy obsession with thinness. But it's been perverted, and global food marketers are seeking to cash in on the trend. One company in particular, General Mills, makers of Cocoa Puffs and Lucky Charms cereals, has launched a multi-pronged campaign that capitalizes on the teachings of the anti-diet movement. This, as I said, was an investigation by the Washington Post and a nonprofit newsroom that covers global public health called The Examination. I'll certainly look them up. So now General Mills has basically taken over and has taken the show on the road with touting anti-diet research that proves the harms of food shavings. It's also food shaving, I'm sorry. Don't fat shame, don't food shame people either for what they eat. It's showered giveaways on registered dietitians who promote their cereals online with a hashtag, derail the shame. Yes, we are just virtue signaling all over the place. And, of course, these influencers promote sugary snacks. And they've got a team of lobbyists that are pushing back, as always, on food policies, federal policies that would, through the Department of Agriculture, add health information to food labels. Remember when, you probably, most of you can not remember when cigarettes didn't say, hey, this stuff can cause cancer. But I will tell you, I was present and reading the newspapers by then when this fight started. And it has been exactly what you'd expect in the land of the free and the home of the brave. A lot of propaganda, a lot of anti-science, rather like what we saw in everyone's lifetimes on global warming. Let's just stall. So there's lots of hashtags, no bad foods, ditch the diet. And there have been, well, 40% of the 68 registered dietitians with at least 10,000 followers have repeatedly used anti-diet language. And the majority using that anti-diet language also received payment, this is public record, to promote products from food, beverage, and supplement companies. Now, meanwhile, back in the United States, the obesity rate has doubled in the last 50 years. Nearly 500,000 Americans die each year as the result directly of excess body weight. And this comes from a 2022 Lancet study. They don't exactly have any skin in the game except to tell the truth about healthcare risks or about health risks. And so this anti-diet approach is shifting accountability away from the food industry for creating these ultra-processed junk foods that are laden with food additives. Here's quoting from one dietitian in Kansas City. "I will always advocate for fearlessly nourishing meals, including cereal," said this dietitian in a video. It was also labeled hashtag sponsored and disclosed that she was working directly for General Mills because everyone deserves to enjoy food without judgment, especially kids. Okay, I'm going to speak as a doctor now and say, if you train a child on ultra-processed food, they will not eat anything else. They will have taste buds, they will have reward loops in their brain, and you won't be able to get them to look at an apple. I was in a Walmart in Texas while I was taking a brief vacation to go see the eclipse recently, and I came across this food that was intended as a first food for infants. So it was, you know, right there in the baby section, and there was no food in this compound. It was all Frankenfood, ultra processed preservatives, just all sorts of things that I would never want to see in anybody, but especially not in an infant who's forming their brain as we feed them what we feed them. And yeah, I guess I'm food shaming. I'm food shaming the company that made it, not the people who bought it because they weren't aware of the fact that it was dangerous for their child. But General Mills actually said research showed that food shaming led to lower self-esteem and eating disorders, and I should underline this, made people more likely to avoid the cereal aisle in grocery stores. So let me give you a little Dr. Dawn advice. You can actually eat without going near the grocery aisle or the bread aisle or the cracker aisle or the candy aisle. You can actually just go around the edges. That's where you're going to find the dairy, the produce, the meats, the fruits and vegetables. They're all around the edges. I'm going to challenge you because I've done this training with some of my patients. And what we do is we try to walk around with a shopping cart and never go down any of the central aisles and make an entire week's worth of dinners. Just, okay, I'm going to have fish. I'm going to have hamburger. I'm going to have tomatoes with the hamburger. I'll need some lettuce. And so on. And you know, you can actually manage almost all of the daily food you need without ever going into the processed food aisles. I recommend doing it as just kind of a cognitive exercise. You're listening to K-Squid, KSQD Santa Cruz, and KSQT Prunedale. K-Squid on your radio dial or LED display or whatever it is at 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7. You can also listen at ksqd.org. So I promised you an anger management tip. Write it down, then throw it away. Research in Japan confirms a simple method for reducing anger. A research group in Japan, building upon previous research on the association between the written word and anger reduction, discovered that writing down one's reaction to a negative incident on a piece of paper and then shredding it dramatically reduces feelings of anger. They expected, said lead researcher Nobuyuki Kawai, that our method would suppress anger to some extent, but we were amazed that anger was eliminated almost entirely. And of course, controlling anger at home and in the workplace can lead to negative consequences. The Japanese have, of course, a lot of stuffing that they do. That's also happens in Bali, where I'm quite familiar with the culture. It's very rude to show anger. It's very rude to show aggression. It's suppressed. And as you might not be surprised to learn, gastric ulcers and stomach cancers are very high. Now, correlation doesn't equal causality, but stress doesn't directly cause ulcers, but it sure does cause a change in the way that stomach acid is put out, and it definitely does cause reflux. So let's talk about this anger management technique because it's easy. Physical objects can help control a person's mood. Acting out on a physical object, rather than punching a door or, God forbid, a person, is a really good strategy. So for this project, they set up their experimental subjects. This was at a university. They had participants write a brief comment about important social problems. They gave them, should smoking in public be outlawed, was one of the examples given. And then they told them that a doctoral student would evaluate their writing skill. However, the doctoral students were plants. Regardless of what the participants wrote and how well they did it, the evaluators scored them low on intelligence, interest, logic, and rationality. To really drive it home, the doctoral students also all wrote the same insulting comment. I cannot believe an educated person would think like this. I hope this person's learned something while they're at the university. So after handing out these negative comments, the researchers asked the participants to write down their thoughts on the feedback and focus on what triggered their emotion. What about that comment really bothered them? Finally, one group of the participants was told to dispose of the paper they wrote in a trash can or keep it in a file on their desk. And a second group was told to destroy the document in a shredder or put it in a plastic box. So the students were then asked to rate their anger after the insult and after either disposing or keeping the paper. As expected, all participants had a high level of anger after receiving the comments. However, anger levels of the individuals who discarded the paper in the trash can, and particularly in those who shredded it, returned to their initial state after disposing of the paper. Meanwhile, the participants who held on to a hard copy of the insult experienced only a small decrease in their overall anger. So possibly the reason the Japanese are thinking about this is I learned about a very interesting Japanese cultural tradition that's called Hakadashi Sara. Hakadashi refers to purging or spitting out something, and Sara refers to breaking a dish or a plate. And so at a shrine just outside of Nagoya, they have a Hakadashi Sara festival annually, where people smash small discs upon which they've written things that make them angry. And people always describe a great feeling of relief and euphoria after leaving the festival. So not saying you have to smash your good china, but there's something rather viscerally satisfying about shredding a document. We do a lot of that in medicine. And I take it one step further because I'm a ceramic artist and I do a lot of pit firing. I also use those shredded medical records. We're still forced to use faxes. That makes me angry. So I really enjoy shredding those faxes and then using them to make art. It's sort of a lemons into lemonade kind of strategy. But there really is some satisfaction. You probably could get the same thing out of tearing it up in little pieces. As I recall, one of the people who is a candidate for president of the United States used to make a point of shredding or tearing up all memos and everything he wrote down, I don't think that was to get rid of anger. So start with a really cool short science story. First of all, the U.S. liver transplant list right now is about 10,000 people long, and 12% of those waitlisted die each year. We don't have a machine to replace the liver like we have a kidney dialysis machine. If your liver is gone, you will shortly be gone. You accumulate compounds in your blood that simply cannot be gotten rid of, and you lapse into delirium. In fact, as sort of emergency therapy, we sometimes will give people agents that cause massive diarrhea, trying to at least clear a little bit of the toxins out of the system. So in a groundbreaking experiment, scientists have managed to grow the beginnings, let's call them microlivers, inside a person with liver failure. The procedure was developed by a Pittsburgh-based biotech company, and it involves injection of liver cells, the hepatocytes, which are where the action is in terms of detoxification, into the patient's abdominal lymph nodes. So the liver has this wonderful capacity of being able to rebuild itself, and if you take out half of a liver, it will regenerate back to its normal size. And in previous experiments in pigs, introducing donor cells allowed animals, with damaged organs to develop mini livers that actually grew networks of blood vessels and bile ducts that actually secreted bile. So for the first human trial, they threaded a small tube down the patient's throat into the digestive tract, then used ultrasound to identify lymph nodes, and they injected each one of them with 50 million hepatocytes each. They call it using the lymph node as a living bioreactor. Now, this mini liver isn't expected to take over all of the functions of the original liver, but it could be an amazing stopgap measure, and we could keep doing it until an appropriate organ came up. Since it only uses a small amount of hepatocytes, up to 75 people could be kept alive on one donor organ. So fascinating strategy. And I'm thinking that because these lymph nodes are right on the outside of the bowel, that these hepatocytes probably are able to sense their location, and some of them differentiate into bile duct cells and actually attach to the bowel. It's sort of what would happen in embryology. And it's, you know, the real estate people say location, location, location. Well, when you're talking about stem cells, that's actually true. Let's flip to an email. We're going to start off with an email from some old friends up in Seattle, the folks at Chemical Wedding. Hi, Dr. Don. This is John and Tracy, Chemical Wedding in Seattle. Hope all is well. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your advice over the years. The taurine for palpitations was a near miracle. We talked about that with another person a little while ago, so I'm thinking that reminded Tracy of how well that helped her and got her to write. I've got a couple of others on the same regimen now with fantastic results. We don't know how you find the time to do all that you do, but we appreciate every bit of it. And I just want to shout out to Tracy because she actually made me a beautiful custom handbag. She said, what can I make beautiful handbags out of the remnants of leather so that I'm recycling. So she made me a lovely recycled backpack, which ironically, and I swear it was before I saw this email, I used today to bring my stuff to work. So I will just say that they do great work, and it's very creative, and I love that my gorgeous handbag, or actually it's a backpack, is keeping something out of the waste stream. So thank you, John and Tracy. To continue with the letter, I'm writing today because of a diagnosis my 80-year-old mother received. After years, at least since 1999, of habitual throat clearing In May of 2023, she had a CT scan that showed multiple abnormalities. That led to a bronchoscopy a couple weeks later, and she had multiple densities ranging from 1.7 centimeters, about two-thirds of an inch, up to 4 centimeters. And that's, you know, getting close to 2 inches, so about 1.5 inches, about 4 or 5 in total. And the sample from the bronchoscopy did give the diagnosis of MAI, Mycobacterium avium intracellulare. She's very active, works out daily, as well as 4 to 6 miles of walking, and has never reported being short of breath. She eats ridiculously well and has managed at her age to have only one prescription. She has always maintained her weight at a religious 120, but just recently dropped a couple of pounds. The most recent scan showed, quote, significant plugging due to MAI. To the point, she's also always taken such good care of herself that she's resistant to the 12-month regimen of 3 antibiotics to treat the MAI. But at this point, it doesn't seem to be there is an option. I was unable to get the names of the antibiotics, but I'm assuming there's a standard protocol. She was told 2 of them don't really affect the gut. So if she goes ahead with the treatment, can you recommend what she could do to keep her system and gut as healthy as possible during that time? She's afraid that in the process, she'll be undoing decades of hard work. Thank you for your time. Our best to you and Charlie, John, and Tracy. Well, first of all, I'm going to go back to the Mycobacterium avium intracellulare and just riff on that a little bit. This is a opportunistic organism. It just goes to show that there's always something. Prize to the person who tells me what I'm quoting. But in this case, the always something is this mycobacterium. It is everywhere. It is in the pipes in your house. It's in the plumbing. It's in the soil. It's in dust. It's in hot tubs. It's in birds. It's in farm animals. Yeah. You are exposed to MAI. You just are. So take that as a given. It's kind of like candida, which can cause yeast infections, but candida is everywhere. Mold and fungus are everywhere. This is a mycobacterium. Mycobacteria are a special type of fungus. They form an unusual cell wall, and they look under a microscope a lot like a fungal spore. So they have the term mycobacteria for that reason. But tuberculosis is a mycobacterium. And one of the reasons that that's significant is because of that special waxy cell wall. These mycobacteria are protected against antibiotics. It's very hard to kill them. And 2 of the drugs that are going to be used in your mother are actually tuberculosis drugs, rifampin and ethambutol. And these do not kill the probiotics. They don't kill the gut bacteria. On the other hand, the 3rd category of drug, macrolides, and this would be things most of us have had, a Z-Pak for a respiratory infection. So that's azithromycin. And the other one is clarithromycin, first cousin. And one or the other of these drugs will be used, usually the azithromycin, because it's easier to take and causes less side effects. But diarrhea is a possibility, and so one needs to be prepared for that. I'm assuming that she has nodular, because you mentioned lumps and they mentioned plugging due to MAI. There is also cavitary MAI, and this is much more serious, and people generally require IV antibiotics. I also want to emphasize that although she's had that habitual throat clearing since 1999, it's very unlikely that she's had this for 24 years. This is not an agent that stays dormant that long. I think her exposure has probably been pretty consistent, assuming she's lived in the same place. She's probably had persistent exposure over all of that time. But as I said, it's everywhere. It does have a predisposition for elderly women, and often elderly women who actually have pre-existing lung disease, unlike your mother. It's called the Lady Windermere syndrome. in those situations. And Lady Windermere historically was a very, very polite and proper British lady who wouldn't dream of coughing in public. And so she would suppress her cough when she really should have just let it rip. Now, people who have an increased threshold for coughing, that is to say, it takes more irritation to make them cough, seem to have a predisposition for this. Also, people with GERD, people who take proton pump inhibitors for GERD or ulcer disease, and people who have microaspiration, that's where you might be talking and you'll suddenly feel like you have to cough, and that means you've probably aspirated a little bit of saliva and maybe some spores are in that saliva. But again, being an older woman, your immune system declines with age. No matter how perfect your lifestyle, there is a decline. So most of what she's doing, she's probably doing. But what I would recommend is lots of fiber, lots of prebiotics, making sure that she eats root vegetables frequently, daily, if possible. Fermented foods in general, and we all know what those are, sauerkraut, kimchi, kefir, yogurt, some form of fermented food every day, and probably some oral probiotics. Now, given that the ethambutol and the rifampin don't affect the gut, I think those are both twice-a-day drugs, rifampin maybe a three-time-a-day, I don't recall, and I didn't look it up. But the macrolide is a once-a-day. So what I would recommend is getting a good, strong probiotic, probably 50 billion organisms, and taking that twice a day and being at least 4 hours away from when you take the azithromycin or when she takes the azithromycin. And that will give the, first of all, dead probiotics that have been autoclaved actually still have beneficial biological activity. So even if you kill them, they still work. And that's because the cell walls of the bacteria are made of something called lipopolysaccharides. And these LPS from the good or beneficial bacteria actually mitigate overreaction of the immune system. They help heal the gut. They do all sorts of positive things, even if they're dead. But some of them are going to survive and replace the ones that are being killed. So you'll, if you feed yourself the right bacteria chow, and you plant the seeds, and 18 months, that's going to be a long ride. The other thing is fiber can help a lot with the diarrhea. A lot of people think of, well, fiber, you take that for constipation, but actually, fiber, particularly the a combination of like wheat bran and oat bran, so you get an insoluble fiber and a soluble fiber together, that can really be beneficial in terms of controlling diarrhea. So I hope that was helpful. And we're at the bottom of the hour. I want to remind you, you're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika. This channel is K-Squid. You can pick up the show on my website, askdrdawn.com, and that's DR or doctor spelled out. We got them both, no periods in there. And we always post the show about a week later. There's lots of gold in them, our archives. And we have, I see, an email that came to us to onair at ksqd.org. Let's see what that one says. This is from Carrie in Santa Cruz. I've been listening to talks by the brilliant oncologist Asma Reza about her pioneering approach to cancer research. Are you familiar with her work? I hope so, because we'd love to hear your thoughts about her work. Her book is called First Cell. Well, actually, I'm not embarrassed because I work way too hard to be embarrassed about not having read the book. However, I will be happy to take a moment and just put that on my little list of things to do. You know, smartphones have been my salvation in terms of just keeping everything straight. So I'm putting that person in my phone right now and seeing if I got the spelling of her name right. And there she is. She's got her picture in the Guardian. She's born in Karachi, Pakistan. And she is the medical director of the myelodysplastic syndrome at Columbia University. Well, since I have some skin in that game right now, you can bet that I will be putting the first cell on my reading list. And thank you very much, Gary, for bringing that to my attention. I actually think that bone marrow, myelodysplastic syndrome, is a very interesting disease that I know a little bit about. So I'll just say that many people will develop just a change in the appearance of their cells in their bone marrow, or rather in their bloodstream, and then we'll get a bone marrow biopsy, and we'll see that they have this myelodysplastic syndrome, and that puts them at risk for going on to develop leukemia of various sorts. People can live for 15 and 20 years with this precancerous myelodysplastic syndrome, and then suddenly, in a blink of an eye, it converts and goes rogue on you, and you've got cancer. If we could understand what's going on with that, it would be an enormous, enormous boon to our understanding of cancer. That is, I'm guessing, some of what I'm going to find when I get that book and read it. Also really like Kindle for things like this. So thank you for the suggestion, Carrie, and I will certainly follow up on it and give you my opinion. And I just want to say thank you for over the years. So many people have asked me things I didn't know and contributed to my education, and a special shout out to the community in the San Lorenzo Valley part of Santa Cruz, up there around Scotts Valley and Ben Lomond. I spent the first 24 years in Santa Cruz County at a practice there, and my patients taught me so much botanical medicine, so much alternative medicine, so much integrative medicine, and, you know, being a recovering AA student, I always went and looked things up. And so much of what I know I owe to the questions and the items that my patients brought into my office to show me. So thanks to all of you. It's Mutual Benefit Society, folks. So another email, this from Fred in Bradley, California. Fred writes, COVID. Hi, once again, Dr. D. Got this from our daughter, an MD at Sansum down in SBA. She wrote, Dad, maybe a good flora to have in abundance. Looks like you can get this supplement online. Might be worth a look. And this, of course, is this doctor coming across this bit of research. This is a study that was published actually, I don't know exactly where it was published, but she got it from the Public Library of Medicine, and it's coming out of it's on the NIH website. I'll see if I can post a link. Gut microbiota-derived synbiotic formula, I'll explain all of that in a second, as a novel adjuvant for COVID-19. This is a synbiotic means that these are products that are synergistic biologicals. So these are probiotics. It's another word for probiotics. And the researchers essentially looked at the known work on what happens to the guts of people with COVID. And as you probably know, there are changes in the gut, and in some people we can find COVID-19 in their intestines and in their stool for a very, very long time. It doesn't seem to be infectious necessarily, but it is potentially reproducing
and that's how it's able to hang around that long. Why this is important is that it's been linked to long COVID. It's not clear if it is causal. It could be that having long COVID means that you don't clear this from the gut, or it could be that having this in the gut perpetuates the immune system's hyperreactivity and leads to long COVID. In this study, it happened in Hong Kong. It was people who were sick enough to be admitted to the hospital. It was a case control study, so there was another group of people who were also very sick, admitted to the hospital, about 30 in each group. They gave them this product, three different strains of bifidobacteria. The reasons they chose these were the ones that were known to be the stickiest. So the most likely, if you take them orally, to actually be able to grab on and hang in there and persist in the gastrointestinal tract. They also gave them galacto-oligosaccharides. These are milk-derived short sugar molecules. Xylo-oligosaccharides. These are from xylose, which is a plant sugar. Maybe you've used that as a sweetener. You'll find if you use too much, you'll definitely get diarrhea because it is not absorbed by humans, but it does provide food for bacteria, and also resistant dextrin. And resistant in this context is when you take a compound and treat it. Like, for example, you can make resistant starch in potatoes by simply boiling the potatoes and then leaving them in the fridge overnight. And the starch basically hardens up into something that makes it less likely to raise your blood sugar when you eat the potatoes. Getting back to the study, what they found was what they were looking for was the persistence of COVID-19 in the gut. And they found that in those who were given this bacteria, there was a very low persistence with a probability of 0.04. That is our threshold for statistical significance of 0.05. So it means about a 1 in 25 chance in the study that it was a coincidence. The stuff is available online. It's made in Italy, and it's called SIM01. I Googled it and was able to find the article as well as find many places online who were happy to sell it to me for about 2,000 Hong Kong dollars. What I didn't have before the show was time to go to the currency exchange websites and figure out how much money that is. Would I say on the strength of this that it falls into the won't hurt, might help category of if I got COVID, would I take it? Yeah, it probably does if I could get a hold of it in time. And could we use it for people in the hospital outside of a study? Almost certainly not. Most hospitals do not allow probiotics, and I would not encourage you to sneak them in. So it is one of those rules that I have struggled with over the years. Sometimes there's a single, you can get maybe somebody to let you use Saccharomyces boulardii in the hospital, but that's about it. And they're very stubborn. I was listening to a probiotic grand rounds locally a few weeks ago, and somebody quoted this old Hackney study that shows that probiotics are dangerous because somebody who had like bowel ischemia got multiple organisms growing in their bloodstream because it leaked across their leaky gut, and one of those was a probiotic, so therefore all probiotics are bad. And that ain't such scientific thinking, but then again, whenever you want people to change their ideas, and I will say one thing for doctors, if you show them overwhelming evidence of success, they will change their ideas. In academia, on the other hand, you have to wait for them to die off. So I will give doctors full points for at least having the flexibility to adapt in the face of overwhelming evidence. So let's move on to another email. This one is a letter that I received in text from, so I'm not going to give a name. Dr. Don, I have treatment-resistant depression. I've come across on the internet the idea of using peptides to help this. So first of all, what is treatment-resistant depression? it's basically you come in, you've got depression, and we give you selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, and we try the selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, and we try the MAO inhibitors and monoamine oxide inhibitors, that is, and the tricyclic antidepressants, and none of them work. So that's treatment-resistant depression. And the only other thing we really have for this that works is radical, and that's electroshock therapy. So it would be nice if peptides worked for depression. So I went doing some research. First of all, what's a peptide? It's a small string of amino acids. As you know, the amino acids are the individual components that DNA codes for. So each codon of DNA states which amino acid is next on the chain. And as the ribosomes read the messenger RNA, they drop an amino acid down in the order that it was listed on the messenger RNA. Now, what that does is put charged particles. There's maybe some of these amino acids are positive, some of them are negative, some of them are neutral. So as they are fed out of this ribosome and extruded, the molecule will twist on itself. And you may have heard about protein folding and how much AI has been a massive advance in our ability to invent new drugs, literally tailoring them to the shape of something that already exists in the body. So that's what a peptide is. It's a small string of amino acids, more squiggly than twisty. And neuropeptides are short fragments of strings that you would recognize them as fragments of longer strings of things like norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin. So the idea of using peptides is really intriguing. And one of the foundations for this is that schizophrenia, for example, one that's been very well studied, we know that there's a whole bunch of neuropeptide systems, arginine vasopressin, cholecystokinin, corticotropin-releasing hormone, neuropeptide Y, and more, that go wonky in schizophrenia. Again, cause and effect aren't really proven here. It could be that schizophrenia causes these things to go sideways rather than vice versa. ECT, electroconvulsive treatment, alters peptide levels in the brain immediately. Neuropeptide Y, galanin, somatostatin are all impacted. So maybe what ECT is doing is shifting the neuropeptides. But this is still not ready for prime time. But there is some interesting stuff, so let's keep going. Ghrelin is the hunger hormone, but it has a natural antidepressant effect. And in the brain, it regulates growth hormone and energy balance. And stimulation of the ghrelin receptor has been shown to alleviate depression-type behavior in rats and also lower cortisol levels in animals. And when you take mice and do a knockout, those knockout mice, you know, you just call up the knockout mouse manufacturing lab and you say, I want one that doesn't make ghrelin. And they say, sure, snip, snip, clip, clip, 18, I don't know even how long it takes, 18 weeks later, you've got your mice delivered that don't have the thing that you wanted them not to have. And you can test it. So when you take out the ghrelin in mice, it alters tryptophan metabolism. And tryptophan's a precursor to many of these neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine. And so there are ghrelin analogs, ghrelin-like drugs that have been already developed to try and treat obesity. They may have similar benefits. Most of this work, however, has been done looking at wound repair and bone building because ghrelin-like compounds do help with osteoporosis. And then there's oxytocin. So there's a compound, a small peptide that is the very tip of oxytocin. Oxytocin, you'll remember, is the hormone that a breastfeeding mother releases. It's called also the love hormone, that warm, fuzzy feeling. I don't know if anybody has ever studied whether MDMA raises oxytocin, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit. But anyway, low levels of this melanocyte-stimulating hormone-releasing inhibiting factor, that's a mouthful, do have antidepressive results. And again, this is in animals and humans. So in one study, it was given subcutaneously. Most of these cannot be given orally for 5 days. And 89% of the subjects showed improvement on the Hamilton scale of depression compared to 20% of those given placebo. So this one, while yet not yet a drug, looks promising. Now, what we do have is a fair amount of data on oxytocin. And oxytocin, again, is a human hormone. It's made in the pituitary, but we have drug-like analogs that are actually given during labor to stimulate uterine contraction. And human studies using oxytocin versus placebo show statistically significant benefit in depression and anxiety. So the dose ranges on these studies are all over the map. It'd be very difficult to know exactly how much to give someone. But interestingly enough, unlike others, oxytocin is legally obtainable in the United States from with a prescription from a compounding pharmacy. And as I said, there's a literature on this, so there's some availability and guidance from the literature on dosing. So I recall maybe 10 years ago, there was a buzz about using oxytocin for appetite suppression. And that's when I had people coming to me asking me to write the prescription for them. I don't remember anyone ever asking for a refill, so I think probably it was not successful for that purpose. There's also an interesting compound that's called Celanc that actually affects cytokine IL-6. That's one of the ones that goes up when you have a bacterial or viral infection, but it's also remains elevated in long COVID, fibromyalgia, and chronic fatigue syndrome. So Celanc can suppress the expression of the gene that's responsible for the production of IL-6. This has not been, so far as I could tell, something that has been done in humans. It's sort of still in animal studies. And then there's another one called Semanx, which is brain-derived growth factor levels. It affects them by raising them, and brain-derived neurotrophic factor is potentially very valuable in the treatment of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. It's one of the reasons why the Bredesen protocol includes regular exercise. And when anyone's talking about Alzheimer's disease or asking me about memory, I'm always telling them about weightlifting, because when you build muscle, you raise your serum and your brain levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and you alleviate depression and raise mood and improve cognition. So if you don't need to exercise to lose weight, you can just exercise to be smart. And wouldn't that be a smart idea? The Centers for Disease Control is warning about bacterial meningitis. There's been a sudden bump in severe meningococcal disease. So 422 cases were reported in the last year. That's the most since 2014. And this year is already on track to surge above that. We're seeing it mount 143 cases in the last 2 weeks. So it's definitely a spike. Now, meningitis is an inflammatory disease of the membranes on the brain and the spinal column. It's headache and stiff necks, but it can be very severe. Bacterial meningitis is substantially bad. It can be passed through kissing or living with an infected person. And even with the best treatment, 10 to 15% of people who get it die. And often one of the evil things about the Neisseria meningitidis bug is that it causes emboli, blood clots, and people will clot off their fingers and toes and lose those because they basically develop gangrene in them. It's this particular outbreak isn't affecting the usual group. Normally, you would expect to see this in babies and young adults, college students. They're often, if they don't get the vaccine when they go off to a dormitory or fraternity type music festival type lifestyle from where they've been, there tend to be outbreaks. Military recruits who are in barracks, again, vaccination has really made this not a thing. This one's showing up in people between the ages of 30 and 60, most frequently in Black people and those living with HIV. But I just want to put a word out there that there are meningococcal vaccinations. I highly recommend that you consider getting one. This is an infectious disease, and looking at this health note, I think I'm going to go over to employee health and get my titers drawn and see if I need to boost. Speaking of young people, researchers have discovered why teenagers stink. Researchers in Germany stitched cotton wool pads into the nightclothes to collect body odor samples from 18 teens and 18 infants. Chemical analysis found pleasant citrusy and soapy-smelling aldehydes in both age groups, but teenagers also had much higher concentrations of carboxylic acids. These are compounds that smell like grass, cheese, and goats, as well as two naturally occurring steroids associated with the odor of sweat, urine, and sandalwood. Researchers have come to the erudite conclusion that this is because of puberty. Hormones drive the production of sweat and sebum, and these compounds are broken down by the skin bacteria into smelly gases. One of the researchers says the change may largely be driven by evolution. Baby odor facilitates the bonding between parents and children, but once children become teens and theoretically less reliant on mom and dad, their stinkiness can potentially help them foster a degree of independence. I don't know. I think that's maybe a little bit of a reach, but, you know, I'll let him have it. A couple more quick stories before we wrap it up tonight. So there's a guy in Germany who claims to have gotten 217 COVID vaccinations. He's 62 years old. He comes from Magdeburg's, and he said he got the shots over about 2.5 years and never had any side effects. But authorities were only able to confirm that he received 130 shots over 9 months. And German officials suspect the motive here was selling his extra vaccination cards to people who didn't want to get vaccinated. They did not file charges, however. But they did study his immune system, comparing him to 29 people who'd received 3 shots. They thought maybe his immune system might be overwhelmed, resulting in a weaker response. Instead, well, I don't know. It's pretty logical to me. His antibody and effector T cell levels were 6 times higher than the average in the control group. His memory T cells, which recall viruses already seen, were on par with those of the control group. However, it's unclear which directions the 200 vaccination would go, but clearly the immune system was not negatively affected. Another story that I will spend just a little bit of time on, and I do mean a little bit, is how to break bad news. This is hard for doctors, and some experts have recommended that you, and I was taught, always tell people in person, don't tell them over the phone. Disclosing bad news by phone has become, of course, much more common since the COVID-19. So in this meta-analysis, researchers assessed differences in patients' psychological distress due to disclosure of bad news by phone or in person. And basically, mean levels of anxiety, depressive symptoms, and post-traumatic stress were very similar for people receiving the bad news, and they didn't have more lower satisfaction. But best practices for giving bad news is set up the disclosure in a way that optimizes information exchange, assess the patient's perception, obtain an invitation. Are you okay if I tell you this? Share the knowledge, name and address the emotion, and provide a summary. And always try to have a friend along, because people don't remember things well after a bad diagnosis, and having someone take notes can be very helpful.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.